from WBUR Boston. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last night, American swimmer Michael Phelps made history again, this time surpassing Soviet gymnast Larissa Latanina to be the winner of the most Olympic medals in the history of the Games. No doubt the years of training, swimming, and hard work paid off last night for Phelps. But what if there's more to it than just hard work? What if some people have a built-in competitive advantage? This hour On Point, beautiful bodies destined for Olympic gold. You can join the conversation. Have you been watching these amazing athletes, wondering what it takes to reach their level? Wondering if nature over nurture got them to where they are? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today for the latest on the Olympics is ABC News correspondent Jeffrey Kaufman, who's been covering the Olympic Games from London. Jeffrey, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Wade. Can you hear me?
I sure can hear you.
Yeah, Wade, I'm at Olympic Park, and as you can imagine...
All right. Well, I think we've lost Jeffrey for the moment. Joining us now from Durham, North Carolina, we'll move on and try to come back, is Adria Bejean, professor of mechanical engineering at Duke University. Adrian is the author of more than 25 books, including his most recent, Design in Nature, How the Constructural Law Governs Evolution in Biology, Physics, Technology, and Social Organization. Also joining us from London is Dr. Robert Chapman, exercise physiologist and associate director for sports science and medicine for U.S. Track and Field. Robert, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you, Wade.
And I wanted to welcome Professor Adrian to On Point.
Oh, hello, Wade. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's talk a little bit about these athletes. Professor Bejean, talk to me a little bit about your book, Design in Nature. It's quite a title.
Okay, well, Design in Nature is quite a phenomenon. It means everything that strikes us with image and with pattern and with rhythm. And one of the, such as river basins, lightning, animal design, and one of the unexpected ramifications of this study of design in nature is the ability to predict the evolution of sports. And even better, this prediction of the evolution of sports toward, in this case, in your story today, faster and faster on land and in the water. Predicting this evolution is, in fact, an excellent small-size laboratory for observing live biological evolution.
Let's talk a little bit about the mechanics. Why would extra height help a sprinter?
Well, the simplest answer to that is that objects fall faster forward when they fall from a greater height. So if you imagine, for example, the runner as a pole that repeatedly falls forward, the taller pole falls forward faster than the pencil. So that's the short answer. The falling forward, which means the rhythm, the frequency of falling forward, is itself a part of the design of animal locomotion. And it turns out, I was able to show, it turns out that this rhythm is designed in such a way that the mass of this body moving horizontally on the landscape executes the movement with least effort, which means greatest distance traveled per unit of food consumed. So all animals are united really by the design of their locomotion. That is the fish, the dogs, and the birds. All of them are one design, and it is only a short step off to the side to say, aha, wait a second, athletes running and swimming cannot be any different than the rest of the living bodies that scour the landscape.
Robert, let me ask you, is bigger faster? And if so, then why aren't we seeing, you know, 6, 7, 100-meter dash men?
Well, we're certainly getting to that point.
We are.
Usain Bolt, who's 6'5". And one of the things, obviously, with USA Track and Field, we've taken a look at Usain Bolt quite a bit to see what direction he's moving the sport. And it's not just me, it's other researchers in exercise science. And obviously, with Bolt being taller, to give you an example, at the Berlin World Championships in 2009, when he runs a 100-meter dash, where he set the world record there, he took 41 steps for the 100 meters, where most typical 100-meter dash men will take somewhere around 44, 45 steps. So because of that, Usain Bolt has a larger stride length and a much faster stride frequency. He takes about 4.28, a lower stride frequency. So he takes about 4.28 steps per second, whereas the shorter 100-meter dash men have to take more steps, 4.54 steps a second. And if you know, there's a very fundamental physiological relationship called the force-velocity relationship. When you try to make a movement and you try to do it very quickly, you are only able to do it with less force. So the slower you do a movement, the more force application you're able to provide. So because Bolt is taller and takes fewer steps per second, he's basically, the calculations are, he's about 17% increase in his mechanical power development per muscle fiber that he has. He's 10% more mechanically efficient, or he has 10% mechanical efficiency compared to about 8% for other world-class sprinters. So at the end of the day, this height that he has is a built-in mechanical advantage, where we used to think that that was actually a negative because it would take longer to kind of unfold and wind up in the acceleration phase of the sprint.
Well, I was a sprinter in high school and college, and, you know, we've been studying sprinting for decades. You know, I have this picture in my mind of a mustached man with a watch in his hand in England training young Jewish sprinters for the Olympic Games. How is it that we're just now beginning to figure out what seems to be fairly simple?
Well, certainly there's been an evolution that's taken place in how we teach elite sprinters how to apply force. And at the end of the day, when you're talking about sprinting, you're talking about force application. Without a doubt, the number one limiting factor in sprinting is vertical ground reaction force. In other words, how much force you're able to drive into the ground to propel your body up into the air. And how to apply that force most effectively is the key thing in sprinting. We used to teach sprinters to sprint with this long flowing motion, with this wide, long kickback, you know, bringing your heel up to your rear end. We really don't teach that anymore. Now we try to teach movements out in front where you can bring the knees up high and hit the ground hard with a lot of force. And now that we have technology, in particular video technology and computer power, you know, we've been able to essentially break it down and determine what's the best way mechanically to apply force to move fastest down the track.
Adrian?
Well, excuse me, Usain Bolt is obviously a very special specimen, but he's not the one that invented this particular trend. We have plotted the progression of speed, record speeds, for the past 100 years, both in the sprint and also in freestyle 100 meters, and found that steadily throughout this past century, the heights of these champions have been increasing. And so when you have speed increasing in time and height increasing in time, if you eliminate the time from both curves, you end up with speed being in a particular relation with body size, and that relation is the same as for all animals, which is that the bigger should be not only faster, but should have the frequency of body undulation lower and should have this force that you just heard mentioned greater. Bigger animals, including athletes, are more powerful. And all these things come together, not only in sprint, but also in swimming, and all together with all of animal locomotion.
Well, we're about to take a break, but a quick question. So I'm 6 feet tall, and I'm very fast, and I'm lining up against Usain Bolt, and it's going to take me 45 steps to get to the 100-meter mark. Are you saying I really don't have a chance?
You don't have a chance because you are running today, which is 100 years after the invention of modern speed running. You might have had a chance 100 years ago when most of the runners were, in fact, it was a free-for-all. The sport was young and everybody had a chance. Now, as you heard, the technology in training, in medicine and all these things have leveled the playing field to such an extent that you begin to see winners coming from that small group where advantage by birth is paramount.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the bodies of Olympic athletes. At the last Summer Olympics in Beijing, Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt set 3 world records, including the 100-meter.
And a fair start, Asafa Pound. Usain Bolt is also out well. Here they come down the track. Usain Bolt sprinting ahead, winning by daylight, and setting a world record, 9.68. The wind is okay. New world record. How easy was that?
I'd like to try to go back to Jeffrey, who is at the Olympic Games. Jeffrey, are you there?
I am, Wade. It's good to hear your voice and greetings from a very sunny Olympic Park on this fifth day of the Games. I just came out of the men's synchronized swimming. I don't know that I should give you, I guess I should give you a spoiler alert, but the U.S. did get a medal. I guess I'll leave it at that and let others figure out what it is as the day passes. It is astonishing. These are my first games, and to see it up close, let me tell you, it's fun on TV. It's a totally different experience in person.
Let's talk about Michael Phelps' 19 medals, most in Olympic history, but apparently not enough to satisfy his detractors.
you just can't do enough, especially in the Twitterverse, you know, where everybody's an armchair critic and everybody has a megaphone. You know, there's so much pressure on these men and women, and it's incredible. And social media just adds to it in an almost absurd way. You know, and these people are all. Even the last place of the finalists are so superior to you and me that I'm just humbled by their dedication, their precision, their hard work. I think you have to kind of laugh off these people who keep pushing Phelps and Daly here, the British diver, to do better and telling them they're not doing good enough.
Yixi Wen, superstar, Chinese superstar at 16 years old. Not only is she winning, which wouldn't draw anybody tempted to cast aspersions, but she's annihilating the competition. Her last 50 meters in the 200 IM where she was swimming freestyle was faster than the men.
Listen, you know, the dope test came back clear. You got to give it to her. But at the same time, the Chinese do not have clean hands. In the 1990s, time after time after time, their swimmers were found to have performance enhancing drugs on them. They said they cleaned up, and yet another Chinese swimmer was thrown out of competition just in June. So, you know, there is the Chinese indignation has two sides to it. This notion that they've cleaned up and that they're just very good sportsmen from a massive pool of talent holds a lot of water and ought to be respected. And yet, you know, in a different sport last night in badminton, there were the Chinese trying to game the system, intentionally trying to lose. They've been expelled from the games because they wanted to lose to get into an easier round where they could get to the finals, giving China a chance at gold and silver. I mean, you know, this these games have always been about finding a way to win and for your country and for a country to bragging rights for countries. But you sure feel it with China here.
Well, in your mind, have the questions about Yixi Wen been put to rest? What do you think?
I don't pretend to have any inside knowledge. I'm going to accept the word of the IOC and the associated bodies that did the drug testing. Those blood samples will be kept for 8 years. If the if new and better tests come by, they can be tested again in the next 8 years, and she could be stripped of her medal. But at this point, she's earned it, and you know, just as Michael Phelps did. You know, this notion that you were talking about, I lost the phone signal, but I did hear what a few minutes of your conversation moments ago. These games are very much defined by two things. These are the games of bodies and of science. You're absolutely right. You know, you have a better chance of being president of the United States than you do of beating Usain Bolt at the 100 meter. It's just that simple. You and I, as fairly average, even reasonably fit guys, just don't even think about coming to the Olympics, because you've got to have the composition, the body composition, whether it's a massive guy like Usain Bolt for the 100 meter, or a very little 150 pounder who will win the marathon, because they expel heat faster. We know the science of the body. We have dissected it in its application to sport in such a way that now we are selecting. It's almost a sports eugenics that we're witnessing here, where people with enormous wingspans, like Phelps, like Franklin, are being selected and are winning massively, and like this Chinese swimmer, because they have the right physique and then they are trained. But understand also, it's not just about body, and it's not, you know, it's obviously a lot about extraordinarily hard work and tedious training day in, day out, but it's also about a science. And I interviewed Julie Foudy, the captain of the U.S. soccer team that won gold in 2004. And I said, you know, so this science, you know, did you go through it? And she laughed at me, and she said, you know, for us it was like a heart, you know, they'd measure our heart rate. Now the soccer players and all these athletes, they're wearing electrodes, they're sleeping with body monitors, even their days off they're being watched. She said, you know, we could take a day off and go and eat a donut. Now, you know, your glucose would spike and they'd say, hey, what were you doing? She said that, you know, the secrecy and the individual responsibility has been taken away, and it's being managed so much by science and body selection.
Jeffrey Kaufman is a correspondent for ABC News. He's in London covering the games. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us. Have fun.
Thank you. I am.
Let's get back to our other guests. Joining me is Dr. Robert Chapman, Associate Director for Sports Science and Medicine for the U.S. Track and Field, and Adrien Bejean, Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Duke University. Thank you, gentlemen. Robert, let me ask you a question. What about the technological advances that aid these athletes? Tracks are especially designed to help their joints. The swimming pools are especially designed not to create waves. How is that affecting the times that we're seeing?
Well, certainly technology plays a big role. And for example, in my role with USA Track and Field, one of the key things that I do is I go out on the road with our top biomechanists, our nutritionists, our sports psychologists, our medical staff. We do something called sports performance workshops, where we work one-on-one with individual athletes in kind of a stations format with each one of those professionals, trying to use our knowledge and our technology and our abilities to help them improve their performance. And, you know, kind of to go a little bit against maybe what Jeffrey said, saying, you know, that there's maybe no way to beat Usain Bolt, you know, we're trying really hard with Tyson Gay and Justin Gatlin to see if we can do just that in terms of trying to apply science or apply what we can do technologically in the right way. And to give you an example, with our biomechanists, we work a lot with our athletes on their starts. And one of the metrics we use is the time from their first movement to when their head hits the 3 meter mark. And we can measure that quite accurately. And just to give you an example, we'll go in with Tyson Gay and measure his start to 3 meters. And usually the first start or the second start will take him about 0.86 seconds. Well, after about 2 hours of working with him, you know, with some of the biomechanical features that we have in terms of video playback, we can put an idealized sprint model of a start and overlay that. It's kind of a stick figure model over his body so he can see it and get this visual feedback of what he should be doing and how he should more effectively apply force. We've been able to get him down to about 0.75 seconds. So that's a 0.11 second difference just to 3 meters. And that escalates as he goes down the track. So if we can get that in 2 hours, you know, the difference between his best time and Usain Bolt's best time is about 0.2 seconds. So just in the first 3 meters, for 2 hours worth of work, we've got about half that difference made up.
Now, the fastest way to come out of the blocks is you get down on your fingertips and you have your right leg in front of your left leg or your left leg in front of your right leg, whichever you prefer, and you explode out of there driving your opposite arm. Now I'm hearing that we should stand up.
No, exactly the opposite. You know, a lot of the most, the weaker sprinters, the most ineffective sprinters will simply pop straight up out of the blocks. And that's extremely ineffective. You want to drive down the track. And in fact, we work with a lot of our athletes, again, with this visual model that we can overlay over top of them. The rear foot, when it comes out of the blocks, there's a tendency to pick it up so that it can come down and hit the track with a little more force, which is what you want to do when you sprint. But at the start, we need to get that foot down as quickly as possible. And if you watch some of the best starters, including Usain Bolt, a lot of times that back foot will actually drag along the track for the first step. And sometimes even the second step will drag along the track, almost like a shuffle, trying to keep their center of mass low and get that foot down quickly so that they can apply force to the ground in that way.
Let's take a caller. Andrew is calling from East Hartford, Connecticut. Andrew, hello.
Hi, Wade. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you.
Yeah, I've been listening to the station. I'm listening about the Olympics. I've been watching it, watching these athletes, and I believe that, you know, it's nature and nurture. You know, these guys work, the ladies work really hard at what they're doing, and, you know, as time has progressed, they have kind of worked into the science of athletics.
Andrew, let me ask you to respond to that.
You mean Adrian?
Adrian.
Yes. Nature comes first. Being born a certain way is a prerequisite for nurture, for all this training that you heard Robert describing, and. So if you want speed, and when I speak of speed, I mean both running on a track and also swimming in the pool. If you want speed, you get it from size. This is why you the elephant in the room is so common that it is not being discussed. It's not just Usain Bolt. Every sprinter on a TV screen is taller compared with sprinters 10 years ago. The same in the pool with the champion swimmers. And there is something else that is obvious and not being discussed. It is that all the sprinters with any hope of winning are of West African origin. All the swimmers with any hope of winning are of either European or Oriental origin. And there are very precise reasons for why this has become this way. They are very important to understand scientifically. We actually explained why this happens. It is all about height, from what height the body is falling. And the punchline is that in sprint, where the body is vertical, the height that matters is the position of the center of gravity, meaning that if you have long legs, you're faster than a person equally tall but with shorter legs. And in water, it is precisely exactly the opposite. The person with a longer torso will be faster because this person rises higher above the water level than a person with a shorter torso. And so once again, nature or being born a certain way today, 100 years after the start of the modern Olympics, is the first step toward selecting a team.
Adrian, speaking of young, incredible athletes with amazing physiques, Missy Franklin, 17 years old, had an incredible weekend. She got her first Olympic gold in the women's 100 meter backstroke.
Here comes Franklin down there. We've got Spofford down there in lane 7, also looking strong, but Missy Franklin breaking to the wall in lane 5. Is her first individual medal going to be gold? Yes! Seabot with a silver!
6 feet, 1 inches. A lot has been made of Franklin's incredible 76-inch wingspan and broad shoulders. Clearly, it's helped her thus far in the Olympic competition, Adrian.
That's correct. You'll see this. Every fast swimmer has basically a long body length horizontally stretched in the water, and the person with such a horizontal length creates a taller water wave. The taller water wave moves horizontally on the surface of the water faster than a tiny wave. The fastest of all the water waves is the tsunami. So that's what swimming is. It's the well-trained swimmer, surfs efficiently on a wave of his or her own creation.
16-year-old Chinese swimmer Yixi Wen has exploded onto the scene, leading some to ask if she was using performance-enhancing drugs.
Here comes Yixi Wen, 15 meters left. Expected is going to double it up, winning gold.
But maybe it's not drugs. Maybe it's her unusual physique. I read that she has, you know, amazingly large hands and feet, and someone described her skittering across the top of the water like a water bug, that she doesn't plow through as much water. Robert, anything to this?
You know, certainly in swimming, it's all about overcoming drag in swimming. You know, if you think of putting your hand in water and trying to move that water, you're going to have resistance in the form of drag. And swimmers essentially spend the hours and hours and hours they do in the pool perfecting their technique to overcome drag. And that's why powerful swimmers with large wingspans tend to do better because, as Adrian said, they can propel themselves out of the water. When they're moving through the air, there's less resistance, less drag. And to skitter across the top of the water like that is certainly one way to do it. You know, another way is if you go back to Beijing, when you're probably aware of the technology of the swimsuits that were legal for use in competition at the time, that were the full body length suits. They were specially designed to decrease drag and increase buoyancy, both of those things. Now you're getting to where technology comes into a play to influence times in that way.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Olympic bodies. With us today are Dr. Robert Chapman, Associate Director for Sports Science and Medicine for U.S. Track and Field, and Adrian Bejean, Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Duke University. Thanks for staying with us, gentlemen. Adrian, Yixi Wen is not some amazing physical specimen towering over everyone else, but she has unusually large hands and feet. Could that really be the difference?
It is that, and I have not measured, but I'm sure she also has a long torso. But yes, the having big paddles is extremely important. you heard Robert mention the importance of getting above the water in order to avoid the water drag. That is important, but but in order to get above the water, the swimmer has to push down to lift herself or himself above the water. And the force of pushing the water down is greater when the paddle is bigger. And that's the principle. Now, of course, as I said earlier, the higher the body above the water, then the greater the height from which the body falls forward. And that took me to the analogy with the water wave that's being surfed by the swimmer. So it's not only avoiding water drag, it is also lifting the body above the waterline, and that requires a bigger palm. And just recently, in fact, last month, we published in the Journal of Theoretical Biology the principle of how to make the paddle even bigger. That is done, I'm sure, in training today at the top level by teaching the swimmers to spread their fingers not too much and not too little, so that the palm is, in fact, a fork that traps between the fingers water that moves with the fingers, and this way the palm of the paddler is effectively greater. It leads to an advantage that's in some cases up to 50% in the size of the force of pushing the water down.
Let me ask you both of you your opinion on Yi Shi Win. In one of her events, she beat her previous best by 5 seconds, which doesn't sound like much, but it is huge. She's only 16. Is it possible that her training is responsible, her own talent is responsible for this enormous leap forward?
You mean for
Yi Shi Win, for her incredible success?
Well, this, as you heard earlier, remains to be seen. But at the present time, you have to applaud the winner. But here is something to keep in mind, because sports evolution is really no different than biological evolution. It is tempting to focus on one specimen and then another, Usain Bolt and now this Chinese swimmer. That is not the phenomenon. The phenomenon is the broad view of how the fastest swimmers as a population are becoming faster, and why and how. And on the other side, how this small population of the fastest runners is getting to run faster. That is the phenomenon. And before Usain Bolt, there were many others. Just compare Jesse Owens with Carl Lewis, and you see the phenomenon. And it did not require Usain Bolt to appear on the firmament. So size is key, how you're born is key, and where your origin is a big contributor to whether you get for yourself a ticket to the race.
Robert, very quickly, wary of Yi Shi Win's accomplishment or accepting?
Well, you know, it's difficult to say in light of the performances she puts up. You see things that are amazing, and you want to revel in the fact that it's the Olympic Games. And time again, athletes who are focused and well-trained and tapered for this particular event and periodize their training for this particular event can perform on the day. And you see it over and over and over again in sport. At the same time, you know, it's difficult to accept the fact that she swam her last 50 meters faster than Lochte swam his last 50 meters in the same event. It certainly probably requires some deeper looking into, and I know the U.S. swim coaches have alluded to that.
Joining us now from Tucson, Arizona, is Sheldon Blockberger, assistant track and field coach at the University of Arizona, where he coaches Olympic high jumper Brigetta Barrett, who will be competing next week. Sheldon, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, I mean, when I was a young athlete, my coaches always talked to me about my heart. And did I have enough heart? Did we have enough heart as a team? What grit? It was all about what was inside of us, not we had to overcome the other team. Can sheer grit and willpower overcome a physical disadvantage at the Olympic level, or is the baseline a perfect physique?
It helps to have a good physique. Heart and determination is good for high school level, you know, for a football team or a soccer team where it's real competitive and that little extra is going to push you over the edge. But at the Olympic level, you know, definitely heart and determination is a big factor, but, you know, it really comes down to God-given abilities at that level. plus a great work ethic, and you have to have both at the Olympic level. You just can't be a hard worker, but you have no physical talent. That's not going to get you real far at the Olympic level, but you definitely have to have some physical gifts at the Olympic level, whether you're a track athlete or a swimmer. You know, golf, you don't really have to have a lot of physical gifts because that is a lot of heart and determination and practice. You know, it doesn't rely on running speed or swimming speed or anything. It's an acquired talent, but definitely in track and swimming and sports, gymnastics, you know, that takes a lot of God-given ability, and that's kind of what separates, you know, the top level from the bottom level.
Sheldon, they say sprinters are born, not made. If you were to break this down, you know, let's say we're talking about great athletes. If you were to break this down in nature versus nurture, where would you come down? 50% nature, 50% nurture, or 80% nature, 20% nurture?
Mr. Chapman made some great points about sprinting, you know, and there is a technique involved in sprinting. And the better your technique is, you know, the faster you're capable of going, you know. So, you know, if you're born with great sprinting ability but your technique isn't that great, you know, there's obviously room for improvement. So, but, you know, I personally think it's about 90% God-given ability, and then the 10% is what Mr. Chapman talked about, is having a good block start and good running form, and you know, that really helps. So, yeah. You know, but, I mean, you can have the greatest form in the world, the greatest block start in the world, but if you weren't born with any talent, you're going to look good, but you're not going to go anywhere. So, you know, definitely I would rather be born with a lot of ability and have to learn technique than to, you know, be born with great technique but with no ability. So,
you know, Wade, one of the things we talk about a lot, and Sheldon sees this all the time with his athletes, is we're talking very, very small differences in performance are the differences between winning and losing. The example I often give in my class is, you know, if you were going to give somebody a 1% increase in the tip you leave them at a restaurant, you know, the waitress wouldn't think 1% is very much. But if I could change your performance by 1%, that is massive in the nature of elite sport. So certainly you have to have that genetic ability to have a chip in the big game, like Coach Bachberger said, to be at this level. But if we can just get a 0.5% here or there, it can really be the difference between a Tyson Gay beating Usain Bolt or a Justin Gatlin beating Usain Bolt, and those things can happen.
So what's the psychology of working with your athletes on this? How do you talk to them when the percentages of winning a medal or coming in last are so small? How do you talk them through it?
At the collegiate level, I mean, you set realistic goals, you know, for what they did out of high school or after their first month of testing, you know where they're at. You know, you try to set goals to where you can get them stronger physically, work on their technique, get the technique better, and you set realistic goals. I mean, not everybody that you come across is going to be an Olympic athlete, and the ones that are, you know, that 1% extra in the high jump or the 100 meters, you know, is really what separates first from fourth place, is that 1% right there. And, you know, it's just a lot of work trying to get that 1% in the weight room, you know, watching film and basically you're just trying to keep things realistic at the Olympic level and just do your best on that given day and just think of it as another meet, you know, with a higher reward, you know, and that's all you're trying to do at the Olympic meet, you know, is just take it like your normal meet, same warm-up, same ritual, and just stay focused on yourself and do what you did in practice and the meets leading up to it, and you should be fine at the actual Olympic Games.
Sheldon, thanks so much for joining us. Sheldon Blockberger is the coach of the Olympic high jumper Brigetta Barrett, who will be competing next, starting next Thursday, I believe, August 9th.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Robert, we were talking a little bit about how you handle psychologically the athletes that you coach. There's got to be a balance between training that you do and saying that, kid, you've got it, you can do it.
You know, one of the things that with our sports psychologists for USA Track and Field, we spent the past year working with them specifically on their ability to focus when it comes time in the competition. And that might sound very simplistic, but the ability to focus and minimize distraction isn't, just some inherent trait. It's actually a learned skill. And oftentimes you will have athletes that will enter the arena and you think they're in the zone or dialed in, when actually they're thinking about, you know, did my mom and dad get their tickets okay? Are they in the stands? And where's my husband or my wife or things like that? And the U.S. Olympic Committee actually, each year after the Olympic Games, will survey their athletes. And one of the common questions is, what are things that you would have done differently now, you know, in hindsight, to help you perform better? And the top two answers always for the last three or four Olympic Games have been, one, I wish I would have trained a little bit less and rested a little more going into the games. But then the other one was, I wish I would have had a plan to help manage things that were stressors, like friends and family and all these other things that oftentimes are supportive but could be a distraction. So a lot of times simply helping the athletes be able to focus in that competitive arena is something that can help them achieve at the level that their training and their talent has led them to.
Adrian, you were talking about the race of various athletes, West African athletes in track. Are we going to start introducing our Olympic athletes by who their parents are?
Well, actually, the answer, I don't know, but I have a question or a statement. The reason why I think this discussion is extremely important is the following. It is really leads me to questioning the future of the Olympic movement. The modern Olympics were started roughly 100 years ago through the vision of Pierre de Coubertin, who obviously brought physical education to the masses globally. And he did it effectively because of certain slogans or dictums. One was swifter, higher, stronger. Now we know these three objectives are met by athletes who are born or who grow to be taller. And okay, that's pretty clear. Another defining slogan of the Olympics is the objective of the Olympics is to, quote, to create a purely egalitarian elite where origin, race, and wealth do not matter. Well, obviously, this objective or this defining feature of the games has gone out the window. Only certain groups have access to, for example, speed on track and speed in the water. And so the question is about the Olympics, as you formulated your question, should the Olympics introduce weight classes in sprint and in freestyle, or actually speed swimming of all styles, the way that weight classes were introduced in the Olympics from the beginning in boxing, weightlifting, and wrestling.
Let's take a quick question from Howard, who's calling from West Lafayette, Indiana.
I know. Hi, Wade. I'll be very brief. Two things: nature and nurture. 100% determines someone's level of performance. You can only split those things up when you're talking about groups of people. So if Usain Bolt was not fed when he was a child, he would not have grown to be 6'5", regardless of what his genes were, had him destined to be. The second point is that practice will always make people better, particularly deliberate practice, has been shown by studies on expertise. And I'd hate to have parents think just because their child doesn't have the perfect body, they can't succeed and do well in certain sports. So I think we have to distinguish between what goes on for elite performers and what goes on for the rest of us who want to enjoy and get better in sports and games. Great.
Well, Well, Howard, I don't know. My putting and my short game in golf may give lie to the idea that practice always makes you better. That's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Robert Chapman, Associate Director for Sports Science and Medicine for the U.S. Track and Field.
Thanks, Wade.
And Adrian Bejon, Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Duke University. Thank you.
Thank you, Wade.
Very interesting stuff, gentlemen. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.